Chapter 16, Some New Theories of Investment. Page 128, Introduction. In the earlier chapters, we discussed three theories of investment. First, the classical theory that investment is a function of the rate of interest. Second, the Keynesian theory that investment is a function of income and rate of interest. Third, the acceleration theory that investment is a function of the change in output or income. In this chapter, we shall discuss some of the post-Keynesian theories of investment and refinements in the accelerator theory. First, we explain the simple accelerator principle in its crudest form, which has already been discussed in the previous chapter in detail. It has come to be known as the naive accelerator. The accelerator theory of investment. The accelerator principle states that an increase in the rate of output of a firm will require a proportionate increase in its capital stock. The capital stock refers to the desired or optimum capital stock, K star. Assuming that capital output ratio is some fixed constant V, the optimum capital stock is a constant proportion of output so that in any period T, KT star is equal to VYT, where KT star is the optimal capital stock in period T, V, the accelerator, is a positive constant, and YT is output in the period T. Any change in output will lead to a change in the capital stock. Thus, KT star minus KT minus 1 star is equal to V into YT minus YT minus 1, and INT is equal to V into within bracket YT minus YT minus 1, since INT is equal to KT star minus KT minus 1 star. So INT is equal to V into delta YT, where delta YT is equal to YT minus YT minus 1, and NT is net investment. This equation represents a naive accelerator. In the above equation, the level of net investment is proportional to change in output. If the level of output remains constant, that is, delta Y is equal to zero, net investment would be zero. For net investment to be positive constant, output must increase. This is illustrated in figure 1, where in the upper portion, the total output curve Y increases at an increasing rate up to T plus 4 period, and then at a decreasing rate up to period T plus 6. After this, it starts diminishing. The curve IN in the lower part of the figure shows that the rising output leads to increased net investment up to T plus 4 period, because output it is increasing at an increasing rate. But when output increases at a decreasing rate between T plus 4 and T plus 6 periods, net investment declines. When output starts declining in a period T plus 7, net investment becomes positive. The above explanation is based on the assumption that there is symmetrical reaction for increases and decreases of output. So figure 1, which is on page 129, is exactly similar to figure 1 in the previous chapter, that is chapter 15, on page 122. So you could refer to page 122 for the explanation of the figure. In the simple acceleration principle, the proportionality of the optimum capital stock to output is based on the assumption of fixed technical coefficients of production. This is illustrated in figure 2, where Y and Y1 are the two isoquants. The firm produces Y output with K star optimal stock. If it wants to produce Y1 output, it must increase its optimal capital stock to K star T. The ray OR shows constant returns to scale. It follows that if the firm wants to double its output, it must increase its optimal capital stock by twofold. So I will be explaining the figure 2 on the next page. Page 129. So in figure 1, y1 and y are isoquants. So y and y1 are lines such that they start from a particular point and it goes parallel to the x-axis, and one portion goes parallel to the y-axis. So it is like a right angle forming, and y1 is also similarly forming a right angle. Now the angle on y is at point M and the angle on y1 is at point N, such that O, M, N, R is a straight line. Corresponding to M on x-axis is K star, corresponding to N on x-axis is K1 star. Here capital is on the x-axis and labor is on the y-axis. So that was figure 2. There is another figure 3 on this page which is a bit complicated, so you will have to refer to the digitized version. Returning to the text, ECAUS note 1: for assumptions and criticisms of the accelerator theory of investment, readers should refer to the previous chapter. So ECAUS has shown that under the assumption of constant returns to scale, if the factor price ratios remain constant, the simple accelerator would be constant. Suppose the firm's production involves the use of only two factors, capital and labor, whose factor-wise ratios are constant. In figure 3, Y, Y1 and Y2 are the firm's isoquants, and C, C1 and C2 are the isocost lines which are parallel to each other, thereby showing constant costs. If the firm decides to increase its output from Y to Y1, it will have to increase the units of labor from L to L1 and of the capital from K star to K1 star and so on. The line OR joining the points of tangency, that is small e, E1 and E2, is the firm's expansion path, which shows investment to be proportional to the change in output when capital is optimally adjusted between the isoquants and isocosts. Page 130. The flexible accelerator theory or lags in investment. The flexible accelerator theory removes one of the major weaknesses of the simple acceleration principle, that the capital stock is optimally adjusted without any time lag. In the flexible accelerator, there are lags in the adjustment process between the level of output and the level of capital stock. This theory is also known as the capital stock adjustment model. The theory of flexible accelerator has been developed in various forms by Chenry, note 2, Goodwin, note 3, Koichek, note 4, and Junankar. Note 2, H.B. Chenry, Overcapacity and the Acceleration Principle, Econometrica, January 1952. Note 3, R.M. Goodwin, The Non-Linear Accelerator and Persistence of Business Cycles, Econometrica, January 1951. Note 4, L.M. Koichek, Distributed Lags and Investment Analysis, 1954. But the most accepted approach is by Koichek. Junankar, Note 5, P.N. Junankar, Investment, Theories and Investment, 1972. Junankar has discussed the lags in the adjustment between output and capital stock. He explains them at the firm level and extends them to the aggregate level. Suppose there is an increase in the demand for output. To meet it, first the firm will use its inventories and then utilize its capital stock more intensively. If the increase in the demand for output is large and persists for a long time, the firm would increase its demand for capital stock. This is the decision-making lag. There may be the administrative lag of ordering the capital. As capital is not easily available and in abundance in the financial capital market, there is the financial lag in raising finance to buy capital. Finally, there is the delivery lag between the ordering of capital and its delivery. Assuming that different firms have different decision and delivery lags, then in aggregate, the effect of an increase in demand on the capital stock is distributed over time. This implies that the capital stock at time t is dependent on all the previous levels of output. That is, kt is a function of yt, yt minus 1, and so on up to yt minus n. This is illustrated in figure 4, where initially in period t0, there is a fixed relation between capital stock and the level of output. When the demand for output increases, the capital stock increases gradually after the decision and the delivery lags, as shown by the K curve, depending on the previous levels of output. The increase in output is shown by the Y curve. The dotted line K star is the optimal capital stock, which equals the actual capital stock K in period t. So in figure 4, we have time on the x axis and k, k star, y on the y axis. So the k curve is a slightly rising curve from t0 to t, and after t it becomes very nearly flat. And when it becomes flat, slightly above is the k star dotted line. Up to t0, the k curve is a straight line parallel to the x axis. Above this is the y curve. So up to t0, it is again parallel to the x axis. Then it goes straight up vertically, and after a certain point, it goes again parallel to the x axis. Koech's approach. The Koech's approach to the flexible accelerator assumes that the actual capital stock depends on all past output levels, with weights declining geometrically. Accordingly, kt is equal to v into 1 minus gamma, the whole multiplied by yt plus gamma yt minus 1 plus gamma square into yt minus 2, plus so on up to gamma raised to n into y t minus n, end of bracket, where 0 is less than gamma is less than 1. If there is no change in income and it is equal to y bar, the expected volume of output also remains unchanged. Then k bar is equal to v into within bracket 1 minus gamma, end of bracket, into another bracket y bar plus gamma into y bar plus gamma square y bar plus so on gamma raised to n into y bar, end of bracket, which is equal to v into 1 minus gamma in bracket y bar into another bracket 1 plus gamma square up to gamma n, end of bracket, where 1 plus gamma square plus so on up to gamma raised to n is equal to 1 upon 1 minus gamma are the weights in geometric series, and equation 2 becomes, so equation 2 is the equation which is equal to k bar, and equation 1 is the kt equation. So equation 2 becomes k bar equal to v into y bar within bracket multiplied by 1 minus gamma multiplied by 1 upon 1 minus gamma, or k bar is equal to v times y bar. Page 131. If equation 1 is valid, then kt minus 1 is also true. Therefore, we can write equation 1 as kt minus 1 is equal to v into 1 minus gamma within bracket multiplied by within bracket y t minus 1 plus gamma square into y t minus 2 plus gamma cube into y t minus 3 plus so on plus gamma n into y t minus n minus 1, end of bracket. Multiplying by gamma, we have gamma into k t minus 1 is equal to v into within bracket 1 minus gamma into gamma into yt minus 1 plus gamma square into yt minus 2 plus gamma cube into yt minus 3 plus so on gamma n plus 1 into yt minus n minus 1. This is equation 3. Subtracting equation 3 from equation 1, we get kt minus gamma kt minus 1 is equal to v into within bracket 1 minus gamma multiplied by within bracket yt plus gamma raised to n plus 1 yt minus n minus 1 end of bracket. Since the term gamma raised to n plus 1 tends to 0, the above equation becomes kt minus gamma kt minus 1 is equal to 1 minus gamma within bracket multiplied by v into yt, or kt is equal to within bracket 1 minus gamma multiplied by v into yt plus gamma kt minus 1. This is equation 4. This process of rewriting equation 1 as equation 4 is called Coix's transformation. Net investment is the change in the stock of capital kt minus kt minus 1. Therefore, subtract kt minus 1 from both sides of the equation to get the expression net investment. So kt minus kt minus 1 is equal to 1 minus gamma in bracket vt plus gamma kt minus 1 minus kt minus 1. So int is equal to 1 minus gamma into vt plus kt minus 1 into gamma minus 1, or int is equal to 1 minus gamma vt minus 1 minus gamma into kt minus 1. The net investment kt minus 1 is called the distributed lag accelerator, which is inversely related to the capital stock of the previous period and is positively related to the output level. So the previous equation for nt is equation 5. To convert net investment to gross investment, add depreciation capital DT to both sides of equation 5. So we get INT plus DT is equal to IGT, which is equal to within bracket 1 minus gamma multiplied by VYT minus within bracket 1 minus gamma multiplied by KT minus 1 plus DT. This is equation 6. Depreciation is assumed to be proportional to last year's capital stock and is estimated by dt equal to delta k t minus 1. Here delta is the not the triangular delta but the letter delta. By adding this equation to equation 6, gross investment IGT is IGT equal to 1 minus gamma within bracket multiplied by VYT minus within bracket 1 minus gamma into KT minus 1 plus delta KT minus 1, which is equal to within bracket 1 minus gamma multiplied by VYT minus square bracket round bracket 1 minus gamma plus delta end of square bracket the whole multiplied by kt minus 1. So then this becomes equal to 1 minus gamma within bracket vyt minus within bracket 1 minus gamma delta multiplied by kt minus 1. This is equation 7. This equation represents the flexible accelerator or the stock adjustment principle. This suggests that net investment is some fraction of the difference between planned capital stock and actual capital stock in the previous period. The coefficient 1 minus gamma tells us how rapidly the adjustment takes place. If gamma is equal to 0, that is 1 minus gamma is equal to 1, then adjustment takes place in the unit period. To conclude, the flexible accelerator is a very important contribution to the theory of investment, which solves the problem of lags in investment demand. It not only incorporates the effects of lags, but also of depreciation and excess capacity in the capital stock adjustment. Its comparison with naive accelerator. Since the flexible accelerator and naive accelerator are both accelerators, their long-run response of investment to a change in output will be similar. Let us consider a situation where output Y is rising at a decreasing rate and ultimately stops rising at a high level. In the case of the flexible accelerator, net investment will increase during several periods before the negative effect of the increased capital stock outweighs the positive effect of further increases in output, and ultimately net investment will become zero. This is shown in figure 5. So in figure 5, we have t on the x-axis and yint on the y-axis. It is a flexible accelerator figure. So we have two curves. Y is a steadily increasing curve, which increases at a higher rate first and then the increase slows down. Int is a curve which goes on increasing up to a certain point and then falls down and reaches up to the zero level on the, that is, it touches the x-axis. So it's like a mountain. On the other hand, in the case of naive accelerator, net investment will be decreasing continuously and will also become zero as shown in figure 6. In both the accelerators, gross investment will be equal to depreciation. So in figure 6, Y is again similar to figure 5. So it goes on increasing. But in this figure, INT starts at a higher point and goes down as we move towards the right on the x-axis. So it is a decreasing curve. Page 132. The profits theory of investment. The profits theory regards profits, in particular undistributed profits, as a source of internal funds for financing investment. Investment depend on profits, and profits in turn depend on income. In this theory, profits relate to the level of current profits and of the recent past. If total income and total profits are high, the retained earnings of firms are also high, and vice versa. Retained earnings are of great importance for small and large firms when the capital market is imperfect, because it is cheaper to use them. Thus, if profits are high, the retained earnings are also high. The cost of capital is low and the optimal capital stock is large. That is why firms prefer to reinvest their extra profit for making investments instead of keeping them in banks in order to buy securities or to give dividends to shareholders. Contrarywise, when their profits fall, they cut their investment projects. This is the liquidity version of the profits theory. Another version is that the optimal capital stock is a function of expected profits. If the aggregate profits in the economy and business profits are rising, they may lead to the expectation of their continued increase in the future. Thus, expected profits are some function of actual profits in the past. So, KT star is equal to a function of pi T minus 1, where KT star is the optimal capital stock and a function of pi T minus 1 is some function of past actual profits. Edward Shapiro, note 6, opposite chapter 18. He has developed the profits theory of investment, in which total profits vary directly with the income level. For each level of profits, there is an optimal capital stock. The optimal capital stock varies directly with the level of profits. The interest rate and the level of profits in turn determine the optimal capital stock. For any particular level of profits, the higher the interest rate, the smaller will the optimal capital stock, and vice versa. This version of the prophet's theory is explained in figure 7. Now figure 7 is a very very complicated figure which I am not going to try to explain. You will have to refer to the digitized version of this figure. The curve Z in panel A shows that total profits vary directly with income. When the income is Y1, the profits are P1, and with increase in income to Y2, the profits rise to P2. Panel B shows that the interest rate and the profits level determine the capital stocks. At P2 profits level and R6% interest rate, the actual capital stock is K2, and at the lower profits level P1 and interest rate R6%, the actual capital stock declines to K1. Page 133. In panel C, the MEC curve is drawn for each level of profits given the actual capital stock and the rate of interest. As such, the curve MEC1 relates the profits level P1 to the optimal capital stock K star T when R6% is the interest rate. The higher curve MEC2 relates the profit level P2 to higher optimal capital stock K star 2 given the same rate of interest R6%. Suppose that the level of profits is P1, the market interest rate is R6%, and the actual capital stock is K1. With this combination of variables, the optimal capital stock in panel C is K star 1, so that the actual capital stock K1 is equal to K star 1, the optimal capital stock. As a result, net investment is 0. But there is still I1 replacement investment at R6% as indicated by MEI1 curve in panel D. The combination of I2 investment and Y1 income level establishes point A on the investment curve I in panel E of the figure. Now begin with P2 level of profits and Y2 income level in panel A so that at R6% interest rate in panel C, the optimal capital stock is K star 2. Assuming again that the actual capital stock is K1, the optimal capital stock is greater than the actual. So K star 2 is greater than K1 at this profit income combination. Hence the MEC2 is higher than R6% interest rate by RM. As a result, the MEI1 curve shifts upwards to MEI2 in panel D. Since K star 2 is greater than K1, net investment is positive. This is shown by I1 minus I2 in panel D. So when profits increase to P2 with the rise in income to Y2, the optimal capital stock K star 2 being greater than the actual capital stock K1 at R6% interest rate, investment increases from I3 to I4 in panel E, which is equal to net investment I1 I2 in panel D. The combination of I4 and Y2 establishes point B on the upward sloping I curve. To sum up, in the profits theory of investment, the level of aggregate profits varies with the level of national income, and the optimal capital stock varies with the level of aggregate profits. If at a particular level of profits, the optimal capital stock exceeds the actual capital stock, there is increase in investment to meet the demand for capital. But the relationships between investment and profits and between aggregate profits and income are not proportional. Its criticism. The theory is based on the assumption that profits are related to the level of current profits and of the recent past. But there is no possibility that the firm's current profit of this year or of the next few years can measure the profits of the next year or of the next few years. A rise in current profits may be the result of unexpected changes of a temporary nature. Such temporary profits do not induce investment. Duzenberry's accelerator theory of investment. J.S. Duzenberry, in his book Business Cycles and Economic Growth, presents an extension of the simple accelerator and integrates the profits theory and the acceleration theory of investment. Duesenberry has based his theory on the following propositions. 1. Gross investment starts exceeding depreciation when capital stock grows. 2. Investment exceeds savings when income grows. 3. The growth rate of income and the growth rate of capital stock are determined entirely by the ratio of capital stock to income. He regards investment as a function of income Y, capital stock K, profits pi, and capital consumption allowances capital R. All these are independent variables and can be represented as I is equal to function of y t minus 1, k t minus 1, pi t minus 1, and r t, where t refers to the current period and t minus 1 to the previous period. According to Duesenberry, profits depend positively on national income and negatively on capital stock. So pi is equal to small a into y minus small b into k. Taking account of lags, this becomes pi t is equal to small a into y t minus 1 minus small b into k t minus 1, where pi t refers to profits during period t, y t minus 1 and k t minus 1 are income and capital stock of the previous period respectively, and small a and small b are constants. Capital consumption allowances are expressed as capital RT is equal to small k into kt minus 1. The above equation shows that capital consumption allowances are a fraction, that is small k, of capital stock kt minus 1. Duesenberry's investment function is a modified version of the accelerator principle. So IT is equal to alpha into yt minus 1 plus beta into kt minus 1. This is equation 1, where investment in period T is a function of income Y and capital stock K in the previous period T minus 1. The parameter alpha represents the effect of changes in income on investment, while the parameter beta represents the influence of capital stock on investment working through both the marginal efficiency of income and profits. Page 134. Since the determinants of investment also affect consumption, the consumption function can be written as capital CT is equal to a function of YT minus 1 minus pi of T minus 1 minus capital R of T minus 1 plus D of T. Yes, D is small, where small DT stands for dividend payments in period T. Since pi is a function of yk, r is equal to ky, and d is equal to a function of pi, these independent variables can be subsumed under y and k thus. So ct is equal to a into yt minus 1 plus b into kt minus 1. This is equation 2. The parameter small a in equation 2 is MPC, and it also reflects increase in profits. This increase is reduced by the effect of profits on dividends and the effect of changes in dividends on consumption. The influence of changes in capital stock on consumption is reflected by the parameter B. This influence results from the influence of capital stock on profits through the influence of profits on dividends on consumption. The capital stock is represented by the following equation, which is an identity. Kt equal to within bracket 1 minus small k into kt minus 1 plus it. It is derived as under. Kt is equal to kt minus 1 plus within bracket it minus rt. This is capital R. So capital RT is equal to small k into kt minus 1. Kt is equal to kt minus 1 plus it minus small k into t minus 1. So kt is equal to within bracket 1 minus k into kt minus 1 plus it. Since it is equal to alpha yt minus 1 plus beta kt minus 1, the capital stock equation can be written as kt is equal to within bracket 1 minus small k into k of t minus 1 plus alpha yt minus 1 plus beta kt minus 1, which is equal to square bracket. In the square bracket we have round bracket 1 minus k into kt minus 1 plus beta kt minus 1 end of square bracket plus alpha yt minus 1, which is equal to kt minus 1 within square brackets within round bracket 1 minus small k plus beta end of square bracket plus alpha t minus 1, or k t minus 1 is equal to k t minus 2 in square bracket round bracket 1 minus k end of round bracket plus beta end of square bracket plus alpha y t minus 2. This is equation 3. The national income identity can be written as yt is equal to it plus ct, or alpha yt minus 1 plus beta kt minus 1 plus a yt minus 1 plus b kt minus 1 from equations 1 and 2, which is equal to within square bracket alpha yt minus 1 plus a yt minus 1 end of square bracket plus another square bracket beta kt minus 1 plus b kt minus 1 end of square bracket, which is equal to within bracket alpha plus a into yt minus 1 plus within bracket beta plus b into kt minus 1. This is equation 4. By substituting the value of k minus 1 in equation 4, we get yt is equal to within bracket alpha plus a into yt minus 1 plus beta plus b within bracket into curly bracket kt minus 1 square bracket 1 minus k within bracket into b end of square bracket plus alpha yt minus 2 end of curly bracket, which is equal to alpha plus a within bracket into yt minus 1 plus beta plus b within bracket multiplied by curly bracket ayt minus 2 plus square bracket, in that we have within bracket 1 minus k plus beta end of square bracket into kt minus 2 end of curly bracket. This is equation 5. Again, the national income equation 4 can be written as yt minus 1 is equal to alpha plus a within bracket into yt minus 2 plus within bracket beta plus b into kt minus 2, or beta plus b within bracket into kt minus 2 is equal to yt minus 1 minus within bracket alpha plus a into yt minus 2. Having obtained the value of kt minus 2, substitute it in equation 5. So yt is equal to within bracket alpha plus a into yt minus 1 plus alpha within bracket beta plus b into yt minus 2 plus square bracket within bracket 1 minus k plus beta end of square bracket multiplied by curly bracket yt minus 1 minus within bracket alpha plus a yt minus 2 end of curly bracket. By taking common factors, we have yt is equal to square bracket then round bracket alpha plus a into yt minus 1 plus round bracket 1 minus k plus beta into y t minus 1 end of first square bracket plus again square bracket alpha into round bracket beta plus b into y t minus 2 minus round bracket alpha plus a into another round bracket 1 minus k plus beta end of round bracket into y t minus 2 end of square bracket, which is equal to square bracket within bracket alpha plus a plus within bracket 1 minus k plus beta end of round bracket end of square bracket the whole multiplied by y t minus 1 plus square bracket alpha into round bracket beta plus b minus round bracket alpha plus a into another round bracket 1 minus k plus beta the whole into y t minus 2 end of square bracket. This is equation 6. This is a generalized version of a multiplier accelerator process. Next, Duesenberry compares this formulation with a simple multiplier accelerator process. In a simple model of the multiplier accelerator, investment equation takes the following form. IT is equal to alpha YT minus 1 minus KT minus 1. Whereas in his model, the investment equation is in the form IT is equal to alpha YT minus 1 plus beta KT minus 1. Where the value of the parameter beta is equal to minus 1 and investment is regarded as net investment so that small k is equal to 0. Depreciation is not considered. The influence of changes in capital stock on consumption is also neglected so that small b is equal to 0. Substituting these values in equation 6, we can obtain the simple form of the equation for the multiplier accelerator process. Page 135. Thus, alpha into within bracket beta plus b is equal to alpha into minus 1 within bracket. So, yt is equal to square bracket within round bracket alpha plus a end of bracket plus round bracket 1 minus 0 minus 1 end of round bracket end of square bracket yt minus 1 plus again square bracket alpha into round bracket minus 1 plus 0 end of round bracket minus again round bracket alpha plus a end of bracket multiplied by again round bracket 1 minus 0 minus 1 end of round bracket end of square bracket into yt2 or yt is equal to within round bracket alpha plus a end of bracket into y t minus 1 plus a into minus 1 into y t 2. This is equation 7. The small a MPC in equation 7 will be much smaller than MPC out of disposable income because it reflects the influence of changes in income on profits and business savings. Simultaneously, the small a in the above equation will be much less than the average capital output ratio, which is the accelerator in simple multiplier accelerator models. An increase, say, $100 in income with capital stock constant will increase the rate of business investment by an amount which is not much larger than the increase in business savings resulting from a $100 increase in income. It will be, say, only $25. Thus, an increase in income will have a smaller immediate effect on expenditure than would occur in a simple multiplier accelerator model. On the other hand, the negative effect of an increase in capital stock with income constant will be much smaller than in the simple multiplier accelerator model. If there is an increase in business capital stock of, say, $100, income being constant, it will reduce profits by a very small amount and will have correspondingly a small effect on business investment. but a part of the decline in business investment will be offset by a reduction in business saving. Such changes will reduce the effect on an increase in income on expenditure for some time because investment will decline slowly as capital accumulates, provided there is no further increase in income. The system will therefore be much more stable than a simple multiplier accelerator system. The financial theory of investment. The financial theory of investment has been developed by James Dusenberry. It is also known as the cost of capital theory of investment. The accelerator theories ignore the role of cost of capital in investment decision by the firm. They assume that the market rate of interest represents the cost of capital to the firm, which does not change with the amount of investment it makes. It means that unlimited funds are available to the firm at the market rate of interest. In other words, the supply of funds to the firm is very elastic. In reality, an unlimited supply of funds is not available to the firm in any time period at the market rate of interest. As more and more funds are required by it for investing spending, the cost of funds, that is rate of interest, rises. To finance investment spending, the firm may borrow in the market at whatever interest rate funds are available. Sources of funds. Actually, there are three sources of funds available in the firm for investment, which are grouped under internal funds and external funds. These are 1. Retained earnings, which include undistributed profits after taxes and depreciation allowances, are internal funds. 2. Borrowing from banks or through the bond market, and borrowing through equity financing or by issuing new stock or shares in the stock market are the sources of external funds. 1. Retained earnings. Retained earnings are the cheapest source of funds because of the cost of using these funds is very low in the short run. There is no risk involved in spending these retained earnings or to repay debt. In fact, the cost of using these funds is the opportunity cost, which is the return that the firm could obtain to repay debt or to buy the shares of other companies. The opportunity cost of internal funds will be less than the cost of external funds. When the firm lends these funds to other borrowers, it usually earns the market rate of interest. If it borrows funds from banks or through the bond market, it has to pay a higher interest rate. This difference in interest rate is the opportunity cost to the firm. 2. Borrowed funds. When the firm needs funds more than the retained earnings, it borrows from a bank or through the bond market. The cost of borrowed funds, that is rate of interest, rises with the amount of borrowing. As the ratio of debt service to earnings from investment of funds rises, the marginal cost of borrowed funds rises. This is because the opportunity cost or risk of not repaying debt increases. 3. Equity issue. A third source is equity financing by issuing new stocks in the stock market. The imputed cost of equity funds is more costly than the opportunity cost of retained earnings or borrowed funds. Dusenberry points out that the yield cost of equity finance is usually of the order of 7-10% for large firms. To this must be added flotation costs plus any reduction in the value of existing shares resulting from the issue. The differential is further increased by the differential tax treatment of bond and equity finance. Note, interest on bonds and dividend from shares are taxed. Page 136. Cost of funds. The cost of capital to the firm will vary according to its source and how much funds it requires. Keeping these considerations in view, we construct the marginal cost of funds curve, MCF, in Figure 8, which shows the various sources of funds. The cost of funds is measured on the vertical axis and the amount of investment funds on the horizontal axis. So there are three regions in this figure. the first region is region A, which is RP plus D, which is parallel to the x-axis, which is investment funds. Then we have region B, the borrowed funds, which is a sharp rising curve. After region B, we have region C, which is equity funds, which is a gradually rising curve. So this is the MCF curve in figure 8. So returning to the text, the region A of MCF curve shows financing done by the firm from retained profits RP and depreciation D. In this region, the MCF curve is perfectly elastic, which means the true cost of funds to the firm is equal to the market rate of interest. The opportunity cost of funds is the interest foregone, which the firm could earn by investing its funds elsewhere. No risk factor is involved in this region. Region B represents funds borrowed by the firm from banks or through the bond market. The upward slope of the MCF curve shows that the market rate of interest for borrowed funds rises as their amount increases. But the sharp rise in the cost of borrowing is not only due to the rise in the market rate of interest, but also due to the imputed risk of increased debt servicing by the firm. Region C represents equity financing. No imputed risk is involved in it because the firm is not required to pay dividends. The gradual upward slope of MCF curve is due to the fact that as the firm issues more and more of its stock, its market price will fall and the yield will rise. The cost of funds may vary from firm to firm, and consequently the shape and position of the MCF curve will differ from one firm to the other. But in general, it will be like the MCF curve of figure 8. If we aggregate MCF curves of different firms, there will be a smooth S-shaped MCF1 curve as in figure 9. This curve shifts upwards from MCF1 to MCF2 when the cost of funds or the interest rate rises from R1 to R2 and shift downwards from MCF2 to MCF1 when the fall in the cost of funds from R2 to R1. So briefly explaining figure 9, we have two curves, MCF1, which is a lower curve, and the higher curve is MCF2. Corresponding to MCF1, the cost of funds is R1. Corresponding to MCF2, the cost of funds is R2. These curves are similar to the curves of the figure 8, but it is more rounded and has smooth, and it is a more smoother S-shaped curve. Returning to the text, the amount of investment funds is determined by the intersection of MEI and MCF curves. The main determinants of the MEI curve are the rate of investment, output, that is income, level of capital stock, and its age and rate of technical change. The determinants of MCF are retained earnings, that is profits minus dividends, depreciation, debt position of firms, and market interest rate. It is the shifts of MEI and MFC curves that determine the level of investment funds. Suppose the MEI and MCF curves intersect at point E in figure 10, which determines OI investment at the interest rate, the cost of funds OR. So before we proceed, let me explain figure 10. So in figure 10, we have MCF curve and another curve, MCF1. So MCF1, only the portion B and C is slightly lower. The parallel to the x-axis portion is very much the same. So it is only shifted axially. Then there are two curves, MEI and MEI1, which are decreasing sloping curves. MEI1 is higher than MEI. Now MEI intersects MCF at E and MCF1 at E1. MEI1 intersects MCF1 at E2. Corresponding to E, amount of investment is I. Corresponding to E1, investment is I1, corresponding to E2, investment is I2. Corresponding to E, cost of funds is R. Corresponding to E1, cost of fund is R1. And corresponding to E2, cost of fund is R2. I1, I2 and I are on the x-axis. R, R1 and R2 are on the y-axis. R1 is less than R is less than R2. I is less than I1 is less than I2. So going back to the text. If the MCF curve shifts to the right to MCF1 with the increase in retained earnings or profits of the firm, the MEI curve will cut the MCF1 curve at E1. The cost of funds will fall from OR to OR1, but investment funds will rise to OI1 from OI. On the other hand, if the MEI curve shifts to the right to MEI1 with the increase in income and capital stock, it will cut the MCF1 curve at point E2. There will be increase in both the cost of funds to OR2 and in the investment funds to OI2. Page 137. The above explanation is related to the short-run behavior of MEI and MCF curves. But the same factors that determine the position and shifts of these curves have different effects over the business cycle. Since the MEI curve depends primarily on output, it shifts backwards to the left to MEI1 when output or income decreases in a recession as shown in figure 11. So in figure 11 we have investment funds on the x-axis, cost of funds on the y-axis. We have the MCF curve and we have two curves, MEI and MEI1, such that MEI1 is lower than the MEI curve. Returning to the text, both MEI and MEI1 curves intersect the MCF curve in its perfectly elastic region. In a recession, retained profits decline, but depreciation allowances remain with firms. So the elastic portion of the MCF curve becomes shorter. Mayer and Koo, note 7, J.R. Mayer and E. Koo, Acceleration and Related Theories of Investment and Empirical Inquiry, R. E. and S., volume 37, August 1955. Mayer and Koo found that firms generally spend more of their retained earnings in recessions and a low interest rate does not have any effect on investment. But when recovery starts, the MEI1 curve shifts outwards to the right to MEI. As a result, there is an increase in investment spending of the firm out of its retained earnings in the perfectly elastic portion of the MCF curve. Thus, during a recession, monetary policy or the market rate of interest plays no role in determining the cost of capital of a firm. On the other hand, during a boom when output increases, the MEI curve shifts outwards to the right to MEI1 and intersects the MCF curve in its elastic region as shown in figure 12. So in figure 12 again it is a similar curve as figure 11. The position of MEI and MEI1 is different. It is in the B region, that is a sharply rising region of the MCF curve. Here MEI1 is higher than MEI. Returning to the text, in the upswing leading to boom, firms borrow funds on interest for investment spending. Thus, monetary policy or interest rate is an important determinant of investment only in boom years. Page 138. Its criticisms. The financial theory of investment has been criticized on the following grounds. 1. The results of studies by Mayer and Koo on investment behavior of firms show that when demand is expanding rapidly, capacity expansion is the most important determinant of business investment during boom periods. In terms of a figure 8, the MEI curve intersects the MCF curve in region B. In recessions and early years of recovery, the MEI curve shifts back to region A, and the level of retained earnings provides the best explanation of investment spending. 2. Mayer and Co. found that firms take a longer view while making investment spending, whereas Dazenbury explains a short-run model of investment. Their results indicate that firms primarily invest in capacity expansion during a boom period, and their overall level of investment will not fall as much as indicated by the Dazenbury's short-run model when the interest rate rises. On the other hand, firms generally spend most of their retained earnings on technological improvements to reduce costs and on advertisement to increase their market share. 3. Empirical evidence in the theory of investment of Co. and Mayer shows that monetary policy is the least effective of all the macroeconomic policy instruments. In the analysis represented in Figure 10, we have seen that the market rate of interest plays only a small role in the financial theory of investment. Critics point out that the main effect of rising interest rates would be to increase the steepness or reduce the elasticity of region B of the MCF curve. This would stop investment when retained earnings of firms had been exhausted. On the other hand, declining interest rates would flatten or decrease the elasticity region B of the MCF curve. This would have no effect in the recession if firms financed their investment spending from retained earnings. Thus, monetary policy would be more effective in controlling a boom than in stimulating investment in recession. 4. This theory neglects the role of fiscal policy in investment, which is more effective than monetary policy. A reduction in corporate taxes in a recession can increase investment by firms. On the other hand, an increase in corporate taxes can reduce investment and shift the MCF curve to the left. Changes in depreciation allowances can also help in manipulating investment in recessions and booms. Investment spending is also influenced by the level and changes in aggregate demand. Besides taxes, expenditure policy and other government measures also affect aggregate demand and the MEI curve, which in turn influence the level of investment. Jorgensen's neoclassical theory of investment. Jorgensen, note 9, D.W. Jorgensen, Capital Theory and Investment Behavior, AER 53, May 1963, and The Theory of Investment Behavior, in R. Ferber, edited, The Determinants of Investment Behavior, 1967. So, Jorgensen has developed a neoclassical theory of investment. His theory of investment behavior is based on the determination of the optimal capital stock. His investment equation has been derived from the profit maximization theory of the firm. Its assumptions. Jorgensen's theory is based on the following assumptions. 1. The firm operates under perfect competition. 2. There is no uncertainty. 3. There are no adjustment costs. 4. There is full employment in the economy where prices of labor and capital are perfectly flexible. 5. There is a perfect financial market, which means the firm can borrow or lend at a given rate of interest. 6. The production function relates output to the input of labor and capital. 7. Labor and capital are homogeneous inputs producing a homogeneous output. 8. Inputs are employed up to a point at which their MPPs are equal to their real unit costs. 9. There are diminishing returns to scale. 10. There is the existence of putty-putty capital, which means that even after investment is made, it is instantly adapted without any costs to a different technology. 11. The capital stock is fully utilized. Page 139. 12. Changes in current prices always produce, ceteris paribus, proportional changes in future prices. 13. the price of capital goods equals the discounted value of the rental charges. 14. The firm maximizes the present value of its current and future profits with perfect foresight in relation to all future values. The model. Jorgensen developed his theory of investment on the assumption that the firm maximizes its present value. In order to explain the present value of the firm, he takes a production process with a single output Q, a single variable input labor L, and a single capital input I, investment in durable goods, and small p, small w, and small q, responding their corresponding prices. The flow of net receipts, capital R, at time t is given by R within bracket t is equal to small p in bracket t, capital Q in bracket t, minus small w in bracket t, capital L in bracket t, minus small q in bracket t, and I in bracket t. This is equation 1. Where capital Q is output and small p is its price, capital L is the flow of labor services and small w the wage rate. Capital I is investment and small q is the price of capital goods. The present value is defined as the integral of discounted net receipts, which is represented as capital W is equal to integration from 0 to infinity e raised to minus small r small t into r capital R within bracket t dt, where capital W is the present value, that is net worth, small e is the exponential used for continuous discounting, and small r is the constant rate of interest. That was equation 2. The present value is maximized subject to two constraints. First, the rate of change of flow of capital services is proportional to the flow of net investment. The constant of proportionality may be interpreted as the time rate of utilization of capital stock, that is, the number of units of capital service per unit of capital stock. Net investment is equal to total investment less replacement investment, where replacement investment is proportional to capital stock. This constraint takes the form K as a function of T is equal to I function of T minus delta K function of T. This is equation 3, where K function of T is the time rate of change of the flow of capital services at time T, while delta is the rate of depreciation attached to the capital stock. This constraint holds at each point of time so that K star, K and I are functions of time. To simplify the analysis, Dazenbury uses K in place of K as a function of T, I in place of I as a function of T, and so on. Second, the levels of output and the levels of labor and capital services are constrained by a production function. So, capital F within bracket capital Q, capital L, capital K is equal to 0. This is equation 4. The marginal productivity of labor is equal to the real wage. So, differential Q upon differential L is equal to W upon P. Similarly, this is equation 5. Similarly, the marginal productivity of capital is equal to its real user cost. So, differential Q upon differential K is equal to small W upon small P, where small C is equal to small q within bracket small r plus delta end of bracket minus small q. This is equation 7. In the above equation, small q is the average price of capital assets, small r is the rate of discount, delta is the rate of depreciation of capital goods, and small q is the rate of appreciation of capital assets or time derivative of small q. Therefore, the crucial determinant of the optimal capital stock is small c, the user cost of capital. Since most firms own rather than rent their capital assets, therefore small c is basically an implicit or shadow price constructed in order to permit parallel analytical treatment of capital and labor inputs. Equations 5 and 6 are called myopic decision criteria because the firm is engaged in a dynamic optimization process and simply equates the MP of labor with the ratio of its price and MP of capital with the ratio of user cost of capital. There are two reasons for the myopic decision in the case of capital assets. First, it is due to the assumption of no adjustment cost so that the firm does not gain by delaying the acquisition of capital. Page 140. Second, it is the result of the assumption that capital is homogeneous and it can be bought and sold or rented in a perfectly competitive market. The myopic decision is illustrated in figure 13, where in the upper portion the two alternative time paths of output prices P1 and P2 are shown, and in the lower portion are shown the optimal capital stocks. So we have figure 13. In the upper panel we have a curve, one straight line with a slightly rising curve up to a point T0. After T0 it sort of breaks up into two parts like a fork. One is P1, which moves slightly downwards, and the other is P2, which goes upwards. That is the output price. The lower part of the curve is a capital stock on the y-axis. In both the cases, time is on the x-axis. So up to T0, this is also similar, where it is a slightly rising curve. After that, we have K1 star, which goes very very slowly downwards, and the other is K2 star, which rises upwards. So this is also in the form of a fork. Returning to the text, so in panel A the output prices are identical up to time T0, and then their time paths diverge when P1 is always lower than P2. With the myopic decision, the optimal capital stocks are identical up to T0 for both time path of output prices. But after that, for the time path of P1 price, the optimal capital stock K1 star moves at a constant rate, while for P2 time path of output price, the optimal capital stock K2 star increases as the former increases. Thus, in the Jorgensen model, there are no intertemporal trade-offs. Assuming that there are no adjustment costs, no uncertainty, and perfect competition exists, as Jorgensen does, the firm will always be adjusted to the optimal capital stock so that K is equal to K star. Therefore, the question of adjustment to a discrete change in the interest rate does not arise. Instead, Jorgensen treats this problem as one of the comparing two optimal paths of capital accumulation under two different interest rates. For this, he takes the demand for investment goods as given by the following equation. So I is equal to K star plus delta. This is equation 8, where I stands for gross demand for investment goods, K star the rate of change in capital stock, delta the rate of depreciation, and K the fixed level of capital assets, which is expressed as K is equal to function of small w, small c, small p. This is equation 9. The condition of equation 9 implies that with small w and p fixed, c must remain unchanged. From the expression for small c in equation 7, this in turn implies that holding the price of investment goods constant, the rate of change of price of investment goods must vary as the interest rate varies so as to leave c unchanged. Formally, this condition can be represented as derivative c upon derivative r is equal to 0, where small r is the interest rate. This condition implies that the own interest rate on investment goods are Q by Q star must be left unchanged by variations in the interest rate. Jorgensen assumes that all changes in the interest rate are exactly compensated by changes in the price of investment goods, so as to leave the own interest rate on investment goods unchanged. This condition implies that derivative square Q upon derivative T derivative R is equal to Q. He further assumes that changes in the time path of interest rate leave the time path of forward or discounted prices of capital goods unchanged. This condition implies that derivative square C upon derivative T derivative R is equal to small c. Combining these two conditions, we obtain derivative I upon derivative R is equal to derivative small k upon derivative small c multiplied by c, which is less than 0. Page 141. It implies that the demand for investment goods in two alternative situations is a decreasing function of the interest rate. This is illustrated in figure 14, where in panel A, C1 is the path of user cost of capital before a rise in the interest rate at T0 time, and C2 is the path after the change in interest rate. But C is constant at time T0. Assuming other price P and W as given, K1 star is the path of the optimal capital when the interest rate is unchanged, and K2 star is the rate after the rise in interest rate. Thus, at time T0, a rise in the interest rate lowers the demand for investment goods. This is obtained by comparing two alternative and continuous paths of optimal capital accumulation. So, to briefly explain figure 14, in the two panels, in the above panel is the user cost of capital, in which up to T0 the C is nearly constant. Then you have a slightly rising curve, which is C1, and a steeper curve C2, such that C2 is higher than C1. In the lower panel, we have capital stock on the y-axis. So here also, the K curves are a slightly rising curve up to T0, which is not very steep. Then after T0, the K2 star rises a little bit, but K1 star rises more, so it is more steeper. So K1 star is a higher curve than K2 star. Returning to the text, Jorgensen concludes that the demand for investment goods depends on the interest rate by comparing two alternative and continuous paths of capital accumulation depending on a time path of the interest rate. Its criticisms. Jorgensen's neoclassical theory of investment has been criticized on the following grounds. 1. Jorgensen derives his investment functions from such assumptions which do not clarify how the actual capital stock adjusts to the optimal capital stock. 2. Jorgensen's theory is based on the assumption of full employment in the economy, where prices of labor and capital are perfectly flexible, so that producers and consumers can anticipate changes in demand, supplies, and prices of goods. But this is not a reality because there are long time lags for orders to be executed for capital goods, which often lead to the fall in investment demand and the consequent idle capacity and labor unemployment in both consumer and capital good industries. 3. Jorgensen's analysis is based on expected quantities and prices that are perfectly foreseen. But foresight is never perfect. Moreover, Jorgensen does not provide any mechanism for the formation of these expectations, except assuming that changes in current prices produce proportional changes in future prices. Further, he does not tell us anything about the expected future quantities to be sold. 4. The classical production function assumed by Jorgensen connects current investment with future outputs, and perfect foresight provides the exact current investment which produces the expected quantities of goods. Again, Foresight is never perfect, and current investment of capital may not be fully utilized in the future. Rather, there may be capital shortage in the future. 5. Jorgensen's definition of user cost is vague. It does not imply that future values of small c uses costs will be identical. Consequently, a rise in the interest rate raises future user costs, thereby lowering the future optimal path of capital accumulation than it otherwise would have been. 6. Jorgensen does not give a very clear economic account of his mathematical results. 7. Jorgensen labels his model as the neoclassical theory of investment, but it seems to bear little relationship with the classical theory of investment. Tobin's Q theory of investment. Nobel laureate economist James Tobin has proposed the small Q theory of investment, which links a firm's investment decisions to fluctuations in the stock market. When a firm finances its capital for investment by issuing shares in the stock market, its share prices reflect the investment decisions of the firm. The firm's investment decisions depend on the following ratio, called Tobin's Q. So small q is equal to market value of capital stock divided by replacement cost of capital. Page 142. The market value of the firm's capital stock in the numerator is the value of its capital as determined by the stock market. The replacement cost of the firm's capital in the denominator is the actual cost of existing capital stock if it is purchased at today's price. Thus, Tobin's Q theory explains net investment by relating the market value of the firm's financial assets, the market value of its shares, to the replacement cost of its real capital or shares. According to Tobin, net investment would depend on whether small q is greater than or less than 1. So if q is greater than 1, the market value of the firm's shares in the stock market is more than the replacement cost of its real capital, machinery, etc. The firm can buy more capital and issue additional shares in the stock market. In this way, by selling new shares, the firm can earn profit and finance new investment. Conversely, if Q is less than 1, the market value of its shares is less than its replacement cost, and the firm will not replace capital or machinery as it wears out. Let us explain it with the help of an example. Suppose a firm raises finance for investment by issuing 10 lakh shares in the stock market at rupees 10 per share. Currently, their market value is rupees 20 per share. If the replacement cost of the firm's real capital is rupees 2 crores, then the Q ratio is 1.00, which is equal to rupees 2 crores market value divided by rupees 2 crores replacement cost. Suppose the market value rises to rupees 40 per share. Now, the Q ratio is 2, which is rupees 40 divided by rupees 20. So the market value of its shares gives rupees 2 crores, which is equal to rupees 4 crores minus rupees 2 crores as profit to the firm. The firm raises its capital stock by issuing 5 lakh additional shares at rupees 40 per share. Rupees 2 crores collected through the sale of 5 lakh shares are utilized for financing new investment by the firm. Panels A and B of figure 15 illustrate how an increase in Tobin's Q induces a rise in the firm's new investment. It shows that an increase in the demand for shares raises their market value, which raises the value of Q and investment. The demand for capital is shown by the demand curve D in panel A. The relative value of Q is taken as unity, as the market value and replacement cost of the capital stock are assumed equal. The initial equilibrium is determined by the interaction of demand for capital and the available supply of capital stock OK at point E, which is fixed in the short run. You will have to refer to the digitized version of this figure as I am not able to explain it together. The demand for capital depends mainly on two factors. First, the level of wealth of the people. The higher is the level of wealth, the more shares people wish to have in their wealth portfolio. Second, the real return on other assets such as government bonds or real estate. A fall in the real interest rate on government bonds would induce people to invest in shares than in other forms of wealth. This would increase the demand for capital and raise the market value of capital above its replacement cost. This means rise in the value of Tobin's Q above unity. This is shown in the rightward shift of the demand curve to D1. The new equilibrium is established at E1. In the long run, when the replacement cost rises and equals the market value of the capital, the rise in the value of Q to Q1 induces an increase in new investment to OI as shown in panel B of the figure. Implications. Tobin's Q theory of investment has important implications. Tobin's Q ratio provides an incentive to invest for firms on the basis of the stock market. It not only reflects the current profitability of capital, but also its expected future profitability. Investment is expected to be higher in the future when the value of Q is larger than 1. Tobin's Q theory of investment induces firms to undertake net investment even when Q is less than 1 in the present. They may adopt such economic policies which bring future profitability by raising the market value of their shares. Page 143. Selected readings. R. Dombush and S. Fisher, Macroeconomics, 1978. P. Anjunankar, Investment, Theories and Evidence, 1972. M. C. J. Surrey, edited, Macroeconomic Themes, 1978. Edward Shapiro, Macroeconomic Analysis, 1982. Exercises. Question 1. Summarize the accelerator theory of investment and provide examples of situations when this theory will not work. 2. Critically discuss the accelerator theory of investment. 3. Explain the flexible theory of investment. 4. Explain how adjustment is made when there are lags between levels of output and capital stock in the theory of accelerator. 5. Explain the profits theory of investment. 6. Explain the cost of funds theory of investment. 7. How has Disenbury integrated the accelerator principle with the profits theory of investment? 8. Explain the financial theory of investment. 9. Critically examine the neoclassical theory of investment. 10. Explain Tobin's Q theory of investment. With this, we come to the end of chapter 16.